So you had a Manhattan for lunch, eh?
I had a Manhattan for lunch. You know what the great author tour is coming to, Don.
You know, I was in the bar of the restaurant downstairs, Rose's restaurant, and, sitting at the bar, and I ordered a Manhattan, and bartender gives me the drink, and it has a piece of parsley floating on the top of it.
I don't have fruit in my Manhattans.
Well, I said, what is this parsley floating, this green piece of parsley floating around in my Manhattan? He said, oh, that's Central Park. That wasn't funny. Thank you for laughing.
I'm profoundly divided, you know, between the martini and the Manhattan. I veer between one and the other. But I do have the perfect recipe for the perfect martini. You pour the gin while contemplating a portrait of Count Rossi, the inventor of Italian vermouth.
Yes, that is a very good recipe. I would say that by far and away the martini exceeds the Manhattan. And they're better for you, too.
I like the juniper berry.
Well, I enjoyed the book. I have to tell you something. I did. I was talking to Richard Nixon a couple of months ago. I was down in his office, and we talked about literary things. And I asked Mr. Nixon, I said, what was the last piece of fiction you had read? And he said, well, I don't read very much fiction. Mostly I read nonfiction, biography, histories, political books. But he said, the last piece of fiction that I read that I loved was The Spike, because Arno de Borchgrave is a friend of mine.
I see.
So I would tell you that you, the fan in Richard Nixon for The Spike.
I have mixed feelings about this. I wonder whether he bought the book.
Probably Arno gave it to him.
That's what I was thinking. I mean, if there were a royalty involved, I might have less mixed feelings about it.
Oh, shame on you. Shame on you. He's no longer president. You have to have some compassion.
He's an interesting man.
He also has a case of the shingles. Very painful case of the shingles.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly enjoyed the book. I wondered, however, you are very brave. You have a lot of the action you describe in Moscow, apartments and streets and this sort of thing. And have you spent a lot of time in Moscow?
They don't let me in these days, Don. But the locales in Moscow are accurately described through the eyes of my defective sources. I mean, I couldn't have written Moscow Rules without being privileged to enjoy the friendship of some quite remarkable men who have come out of the KGB and out of the Soviet Army High Command. And have been able to describe to me firsthand in many hundreds of hours of conversation places that no Westerner has visited or will ever visit, unless perhaps the fictional scenario comes about. I mean, places like the Special Forces base at Kovrov in the Moscow Military District, which is the base for the coup. To my knowledge, no Westerner has ever visited that place. So, you know, the Soviets have attacked me many times in their media. The KGB has made me a target for smear campaigns and other exercises and disruption over the years.
Not a physical target.
Not a physical target, no. And I'm not paranoid about these things. If you worry too much about that kind of thing, you wouldn't walk out in the morning for fear of being run over by a bus.
But you do check your mailbox for any ticking packages.
You take some reasonable precautions in life in going about your business. And one of the precautions I take these days is I do not travel to Moscow. I mean, academics that I know have been drugged. Photographed in compromising positions. None of them has been persuaded to defect or change sides or even get terribly excited about these things long term. But the Soviets know what they're doing in these areas. And so I'm careful.
Well, you did something very similar to what Martin Cruz Smith did when he wrote Gorky Park. He was a tourist in Moscow for 2 weeks. That was the extent of his direct research. And he captured the feeling pretty well, as you did. And another thing that you did, and I think it takes a certain amount of bravery on the part of a writer who has not been, for any length of time at least, in a strange country, talking about the people, the way they grow up, the way they associate, talk to each other.
Well, you see, I know these people. I know Sasha Preobrazhensky. I know Felix Nikolsky, who's my favorite character in the book, the boozy, drunken KGB philosopher, who was capable of saying and explaining why and how he seduced the wife of an embassy colleague, "Oh, I got into her bed the way that Mephistopheles got into the house of Dr. Faust, because of a poodle, a black poodle. You remember Goethe's version. I know Russians like this. The ones that I know best are people now living in the West as émigrés or defectors. But they are men, like my characters, who love their country and hate their government and would like to change that government, and are in the West because they saw no possibility of changing the system from within. You will see from the book that I have a considerable command of drinking expressions in Russian. This has required intense research through the night in those wonderful metaphysical conversations that Russians love to have about 4 o'clock in the morning, in which they solve all the problems of their country and the world. The only trouble is, typically, come the dawn, they have forgotten the decisions that they reached at 4 a.m. No, I feel that I have come, in the course of researching and writing Moscow Rules, to know something, some of the Russians, and to feel their soul, to feel their heartbeat.
Well, the use of their slang. Repeatedly they refer to black asses, or fuck your mother, is another phrase that they... These are not Western phrases.
There is a remarkable repertoire of cursing in Russian. The Yabuya Mut school of cursing, to use the Russian expression. Russians, when they are taxed with the variety of swear expressions, of dirty words that they use involving what should be done to so-and-so's relative or mother, blame it on the Turks and the influence that Asiatic peoples who have occupied part of their territory over the centuries and indeed millennia have had on their language. They say that all of this has its origin in Turkic swear words. There's some truth in that, but the Russians are enthusiastic and colorful in their choice of language. And as the book reveals, I mean, when you look at a character like the fictional Marshal Zotov in the book, this bulldozer of a man, who is your ultra-saber-rattling militarist chauvinist pig in some ways, but interesting, not without imagination. You will also understand that the Russian, the great Russian, is perhaps competing with the Afrikaner for the rank of the most racially prejudiced man on earth. Their feeling, I mean, Chernozhopi, the phrase you referred to earlier, which could be roughly translated as niggers, is the way they describe their own Central Asian peoples. You can imagine how they talk about third world countries that they're dealing with. And of course, this is the reason why in real life the Soviets aren't really all that popular in the third world countries where they have exposure, because the chemistry of their attitudes comes across. People can sense these things.
While you are an extreme critic of the Soviet Union, you also write to a certain degree with amount of affection, it seems to me, for some Russians. I mean, so your characters, your Russian characters, do come off sympathetically in many, many instances. What is this, a love-hate relationship with the Soviet Union?
I think it's part of the process of becoming a novelist, Don. You know, at the end of the day, if you're going to write a piece of fiction which works as fiction, it can't begin and end as a scenario or a political agenda, or a white paper, or a PhD thesis, or a piece of journalistic reportage. The characters have to live, and once the characters live, you are dealing with humanity in all its complexity and chiaroscuro of motivation. And the Russians who live in Moscow Rules may be terrifying, some of them. I mean, my hero is not a straightforward hero. I mean, he is a terrifying man in some ways. Absolutely ruthless, willing to lie, steal, and cheat, make marriages of convenience, betray trusts, betray friends in order to get his way. But you're digging deeper, you're digging a little deeper. And if Moscow Rules works as a novel, I think it is because I have allowed the humanity of these characters to take precedence over any scenario or scaffolding of journalistic research or of political opinion or analysis.
One thing you did that I found very interesting, because I haven't read very much about this, was the chapter, a couple of chapters that you set in Afghanistan. I think the first time I've read to any degree, at least anything on a fictional basis, about what's going on there. To me, what's happening in Afghanistan is a blank, just a blank.
Mm. Well, again, the motivation for what the Soviets are doing in Afghanistan is complicated, and has to be understood against the background of their history and their historical reflexes. So the story told in Moscow Rules of how they were panicked into intervening by the fact that they'd set up one stooge in charge of Kabul after another and lost control of all of them, for one reason or another, and then become convinced that their then stooge, Hafizullah Amin, was dealing under the table with the Americans and maybe the Chinese and the Pakistanis, so they had to get rid of him quick. I think this picture of panic and confusion and the Chronicle of the Three Stooges reflects very closely the bungling, incompetent, desperate way in which the Soviets came to get into Afghanistan. There's a longer-term strategy involved. We must not forget that the border between Afghanistan and Iran is ideal tank country, and if they ever want to go into Iran, as they may want to do at some stage in the future, and my fictional chief of staff wants to do in the book, that's a very good access route for them. But the story of the deliberations that took place, the story of the KGB hit team going to Kabul and killing the then president, machine-gunning him in his own palace in the presence of his mistress with his glass of fruit juice or scotch in his hand, this is based in large part on friends of mine, one in particular, a former KGB officer who was involved in the planning of the Afghan operation and subsequently in running paramilitary operations against the Afghan guerrillas. So, all right, it is a novel. This is a parallel reality. It is not the actual world. But it's a novel with secrets to tell.
You're living in London now.
Well, I divide my time. I think I'm really in process of becoming a defector to the United States, Don, because I bought myself an amateur farm in New York State, where I'm spending a great deal of my time.
Where's that?
It's upstate. It's not far from Albany.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how often do you come to the United States to live?
I'm here for the majority of the time. This
majority?
Is my home.
So, but you still keep a pied-à-terre in London?
I keep a pied-à-terre in London where my two beautiful daughters are living.
Are you still, so you're no longer with The Economist?
Well, one of the benefits and boon blessings of success in writing novels is that you can give up being an employee. When I wrote The Spike with Deborah, I was doing the equivalent of three full-time journalistic jobs as editor of The Economist's intelligence bulletin, as a syndicated columnist for the Daily Telegraph in London, and as an author of magazine pieces and non-fiction books. Since then, I've been able to relinquish most of the routine responsibilities, determine my own time and place, and give myself over more and more to the creating of these works of imagination. And I think that the quality of the writing for that reason may have improved.
Well, let's face it, Robert Moss, most novelists do not give up honest work because most writers cannot sell enough copies of a novel to do what you have been skillful enough to do now on a full-time basis.
It's important to any novelist, whatever degree of independence he may have, to go back to the well where he derived some of his original ideas. I think novelists, you know, should write about what they know best. What I think I know best has to do with conflicts of loyalties and motivations. I'm attracted to situations that are dangerous and involve intrigue. I suppose I like the smell of gunpowder, the smell of cordite. I've been in wars and revolutions. I've known spies and terrorists. I write of these people. Had I been a Pennsylvania coal miner, I might write about Pennsylvania coal mines. As the cliched foreign correspondent in the dirty raincoat in the shady bar, rubbing shoulders with dubious characters, I write out of that milieu, and I return to it from time to time. So I keep my hand in as a correspondent and a journalist, but the beauty of the situation is I don't have to do that for a living.
Yes, it's obvious that you are not a regional writer or a little writer. You are interested in international affairs and a much wider global scope than a Pennsylvania coal miner, who, incidentally, I have interviewed, and he did write a wonderful book about...
Exactly.
The Pennsylvania... It was indeed Pennsylvania coal mine.
Exactly.
One of the... I must have interviewed him 12 years ago, and he was a wonderful writer, and that was his only book. I guess he never got far enough away from the Pennsylvania coal mine to write anything else. You have written a number of works of nonfiction. Is that correct?
Yes.
Which
you
don't have those listed here.
Well, on the inside cover of a novel like Moscow Rules, I list the other works of fiction because those are what people will turn to. The very first book I wrote and published when I was 25 was a book called Urban Guerrillas in the English edition, The War for the Cities Over Here, which was the first book to take a comprehensive look at international urban terrorism as it was developing and is still a standard text in NATO academies and military colleges and police schools around the world. And I wrote several books after that time about Latin America, about the conditions under which democracies collapse. I wrote a book rather similar to the one Revel has just published, the French, very distinguished French journalist, titled The Collapse of Democracy, about the threats to liberal democracy, internal and external. And all these books received wonderful reviews and sold, you know, about 5,000 copies.
Well, in your Star Wars book, Death Beam and Moscow Rules and the Spike, what you have done is to reach people with much of the same material you were writing about before. You're writing, in effect, modern history. And it seems to me, all of the writers I have talked to seem to agree, that you can tell what's going on in our world and in the past if you tell it in a novelized form, because you are then telling a story rather than providing a sociological or political tract, which an academic might prefer to read, or someone doing research. But for someone who wants to enjoy a story and still learn, I mean, how can he beat a Robert Moss book?
Somerset Maugham, who was one of the original writers of espionage fiction with his novel Ashendon, set in Geneva in the early part of the century, said in his preface to that book, a line which has since become celebrated, a story should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. An old-fashioned view. Of course, an old-fashioned view. But the first purpose of the writer, in my opinion, is to keep the reader turning the page. If he can't do that, if he can't create the drama and excitement to make him go on, then he's lost everything. I started as an academic. I was a university professor in Australia before I became anything else. I was the youngest university professor in the country at the age of 21, in ancient history, by the way. I wrote various theses, I have various academic degrees and awards. My principle in doing these things was to write something worth reading. I fell out with my academic profession in the discipline of history when I discovered that it was becoming so clogged with teutonisms and complicated language and footnotes that it was missing out on the possibility of communicating anything to the broader public. So I'm interested in reaching the broader public. I'm interested in ordinary people. I'm interested in giving them an insight into worlds that they may not personally have experienced but can enter through the vehicle of a novel like Moscow Rules.
Do you miss Australia?
It's a country of broad horizons in landscape very similar to this. I haven't been there for a long time. I'm going back this year. I want to have a look. So much is bubbling up and fermenting in the movie industry and in other creative forms of life in Australia. I want to go and test the waters again.
How long has it been since you've been there?
15 years. I spent most of my adult life in England.
I met a couple of your compatriots, Thomas Keneally, very fine writer.
Yes.
And Morris West was here,
yes,
a year or so ago. What a wonderful book called The World is Made of Glass.
Yes, I love that book. That's his best.
Well, you certainly have written some page turners. You're going to stick to the fiction genre?
I'm deeply involved in another novel at the moment, which goes back in time to the era of the 1930s. As a story of love and danger. I have three more novels I want to write after that. One's in the period of the American Revolution, but again a story of espionage and intrigue, Tory subversion. Two more contemporary. I think I will stick to fiction because I am beginning to find myself as a writer. You know, early success may be as difficult sometimes as early failure. It may be more comfortable. It may be cushier. But the first novel that I published was The Spike. It was an overnight success. It sold millions of copies around the world. A very controversial book. A book which has many flaws as a work of fiction, which I would be the first to recognize. A book done with a co-author. A book that achieved a degree of renown, notoriety, and commercial success I had never anticipated. That created a great problem for me. Where do you go for an encore? It changed my life. Since then, I've been gradually finding myself. I haven't had any difficulty finding myself in terms of commercial success, but I really believe that with Moscow Rules, I've begun to find myself as a novelist, as well as a writer of espionage, fiction, and all the rest of it. And I want to go further. I want to explore paths that have just been opening up to me.
This farm up in Albany is not a working farm, I hope.
That's a working farm.
It is a working farm.
I don't expect to make money out of it,
well,
but I expect to enjoy myself.
It's going to cut into your working habits. I mean, your real literary working habits, if you have to go out there and plow fields.
Oh, I don't know.
Well, milk cows.
The trouble with modern urbanized man, Don, is he cuts himself off from so much and puts himself, you know, in a very narrow tunnel sometimes. His world is so confined, his horizon so circumscribed. I like animals, I like to be around them, it's horse country. I like riding horses. Australians, as you know, sometimes never learn to walk, but learn to ride horses and to swim and have gills. You know, these are things Australians do well. They're things I do well and enjoy being able to do. And I like to be able to smell clean air.
Well, I hope you have a little soundproof room where you can write where you don't have to hear the roosters. Robert Moss, thank you very much for talking to me. It was fun talking to you. I really enjoyed the book, and I'll look forward to the new one that comes out.
Thank you, Don. Thank you. Enjoyed myself.